This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim.
This week on the show, we want our content to follow us. Another set-top box like we needed one, and Facebook's facelift. All this on This Week in Media, episode 129. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media, and we are recording it live. So for those of you who are watching and listening live now via Twit Live TV, we welcome you. We will interact with you at the end of the show. We'll definitely take some questions like we did last week. For those of you listening via iTunes, online, on your iPod, whatever, welcome back. Thank you for listening and joining us. Okay, so on this week's edition, well, I guess I should introduce myself first. I'm Daisy Whitney. I'm the host of the New Media Minute. And I write for TV Week, and I thank you for tuning in. So with me today, I have Susan Bratton.
Hello, Daisy.
Good to have you here. Susan is the CEO of Personal Life Media. She's been on a lot recently, and we appreciate that. And Personal Life Media, for those of you who don't know, is a network of 40 podcasts.
And blogs.
And blogs. Mm-hmm. And there you go. And we love having Susan here. Susan actually is going to South by Southwest next week.
Yes.
And she will be handling our recording of TWIM. So thank you very much for doing that, because she's got like her backpack, I guess. Her backpack with all of the audio
all
podcasting
goods.
Gear and everything.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. I try to do as little work as possible and have as many people do the work as I can. So Susan volunteered to do that. Also in the studio, I have David Rewalt.
Hello, Daisy. How
good
are
to see you?
I'm
very good. Thank you for being on here. Now, David is a marketing professional.
That's a good way to put it. Formerly of Viz Media, now out on my own doing business development and marketing sort of stuff. So,
and what's your focus going to be? Just so people know, kind of like what area are you in? I know at Viz you did a lot of licensing of obviously their products.
Licensing and retail marketing at Viz. I want to focus more on business development and new media implementation for companies.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I like it. Sounds good. Yeah. And from Los Angeles, Skyping in. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Daisy.
Good to see you. How are you? How's the weather in LA today? Is it lovely?
It's a little overcast today.
And how are the French maids?
They're doing well. We're getting ready for the Streamy Awards. There might be an appearance by the French maids at the Streamy Awards.
Now, that's going to be March 28th in Los Angeles, and Tim Street is the executive producer of French Maid TV. So, and the Streamy Awards, I did some voting for that over the weekend, but for those who are just kind of getting familiar with it, explain what the Streamy Awards is.
Streamy Awards is like the best of internet video, and so we've got a group of people together. There's been some voting on different videos, and come the 28th of March, we'll see who wins the first Streamy Awards.
Will there be little statuettes or anything to hand out?
I believe there are going to be some trophies there.
Oh, very nice, very nice. So before we get started, and actually I do kind of have some housekeeping things to go over, but before we get started, I want to let you know that this episode is sponsored by Audible, which, as you probably know, you've heard us talk about Audible before, is the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. And if you go to audiblepodcast.com/twim, you can get a free audiobook. Now, Susan and I were talking about this on the drive up here, and I am going to toss to Susan right now because she had a couple really key points about the Audible Listeners Club, and I'm going to let her share those details.
Okay, I'm on four.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Well, I'm a member of the Audible Listeners Club, and they are a really good sponsor for a lot of shows in the internet, including TWIM. And the thing that I think is really good about it is if you join audiblepodcast.com/TWIM, then you're part of the Audible Listeners Club, and you get better prices on your book. So you get your free gift no matter what, but you can also get better rates. So if you're buying a bestseller, sometimes it could be $20 or $30, but you get points and special rates for being kind of in the club. And so that's really what you're doing when you support TWIM, is you're buying into that club, and that club is a good thing. It really pays off.
All right, we like that. And I'm going to recommend a book to you. I'm going to recommend Breaking Dawn. And I know you guys know that I'm a big Stephanie Meyer fan, but I want to recommend Breaking Dawn and actually the entire Twilight series. And, you know, I know we have a lot of male listeners And I know a lot of guys who are listening to this book and are enjoying it quite a bit. So I'm going to share that with you, and I'm enjoying it. So yeah, there you go. That's what I have to say. Thank you, Audible, and check it out. Okay, so before we get into stories, I have a couple housekeeping notes. So last week we talked about... How about that? We're doing the whole room now. Well, last week we talked about show notes and having listeners who have podcasts do show notes for us. And I actually had a couple offers. So thank you so much for everyone who offered. And I'm giving the opportunity to my friend Joy Nordenstrom with Joy of Romance. She has a podcast, Intelligent Love 411 for Men on iTunes. She is going to be doing our show notes for the next few months. I don't know for certain that we're going to start this week because I'm actually going to house them on my website. We decided to do this because, you know, Alex, it talks a lot. Oh, and I didn't even tell you guys. Sorry. Alex isn't here today. Anyway, so we've talked about this before on the show is, you know, Alex is sort of always in the process of revamping the Pixel Core website. And, you know, Alex and I talked over the weekend and we just decided it would be easier for me just to go ahead and house them on my own site, which I'm going to be relaunching this week too. So that's why you may get show notes for this episode. And if not, you'll definitely get them for the following week's episode. Thank you, Joy, for doing them. And I will Twitter the link. We'll also have that link on the Pixel Core homepage when you go to TWIM. So you'll be able to find it that way. You'll be able to get your show notes. And okay, so that is that so far, and let's get started. Next week is South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. I'll be there. Susan will be there. Tim will be on the show as well. Any preliminary thoughts on kind of like what, Susan, what's going to be, I don't know, what are people going to be talking about at the show besides the economy? Actually, you know, there's a story. My dad sent it to me this morning because he lives in Austin. The South by Southwest is kind of shaping up to do pretty well, despite obviously all of the, you know, all the problems with the economy. What are you sort of your initial thoughts on the show?
Well, I am doing a series of interviews at the show, actually, working with Aaron Strout of Powered. And we're interviewing a lot of the luminaries that are attending. I'm talking more into my mic because I saw in the chat room that people were having a hard time hearing me. So I want some feedback on that, too, by the way. But Aaron and I are going to interview some of the luminaries at South by Southwest about community and about how community and brand intersect. And if you're a brand and you want to create a platform for community, what are the tips and ideas that you might be able to get? So I'm actually there gathering some information about an area that I think is a really interesting part of internet marketing, social media marketing, and that's the world of community.
Okay, Tim, what will you be doing at South by Southwest?
Well, I'm going to be interviewing people for my blog, onetimstreet.com, but I'm also going to be there for marketing over coffee, and I'm going to be interviewing people, marketing people, asking them, why did they come to South by Southwest? Why is South by Southwest so important to online marketers?
You know, that's a good question. David, why do you think South by Southwest has become so important? Because it has. I mean, this is a show, and I sort of look at my role as a reporter at Television Week. I mean, we covered it for the first time last year, and obviously that's because, you know, we've been increasingly covering new media and online video and so on, but it's nothing that we didn't have it on our radar screen. And I think a lot of people have traditionally thought of South by Southwest as a film festival, which it still is, as a music festival, which it still is. I mean, it's definitely known for, you know, for breaking a lot of independent artists and independent musicians, but also is increasingly sort of a hub for interactive. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of, I mean, I've been looking at the speaker list. I mean, not only will you see, you know, Kent Nichols there and Zadi Diaz and whatnot, Brian Brushwood at Scam School, but you'll also find, you know, folks on the panel that I'm doing are, you know, executives from Digitas, the ad agency. Mm-hmm. So what do marketers think about South by Southwest?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's actually sort of naturally evolved to be a hub for this. And I think it's a great example of how viral marketing in this community has taken something that's been a music festival, then a film festival, other things like that, and actually sort of self-evolved it into this hub for, you know, an online media frenzy. And, you know, I think it happened naturally. I don't think it was one of those things where there's this particular spark or that particular spark that made it happen. I think it's sort of glommed onto each other as the years went by with it. And every year it gets bigger and bigger for the online marketer. So it's like, well, I have to be there this year and I have to be there next year. And it just turned into that. I don't know that there's any particular thing you can point to say, why is it so important? It just kind of became that way.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the role that that it's taken on. And, you know, one of my favorite things about the show is remembering to bring my Converse sneakers and my hoodies, because if I wear anything else, I will look like a dork. I look like a poser. The real story behind Boxy and Hulu parting ways came out last week. We've been talking about Boxy and Hulu a lot on this show. I've talked about it on the New Media Minute, etc. So basically, poor little Boxy.
Poor little Boxy.
I feel so bad for Boxy, because I really liked what this company was doing. And I just, when we said this last week, and I just think it's going to be increasingly hard for this company to make it, because now NBC Universal, 20th Century Fox Television, Warner Brothers, Sony Pictures, and Disney. So basically, we have like all the major studios are banding together to create yet another personalized, broadband-delivered internet video service. So they've joined together with a service called Zillion TV. And essentially, there's a $100 activation, fee. It starts out as a set-top box play. And I think eventually, like a lot of set-top box plays, they always say they want to, you know, migrate it. So it's just sort of a pure, you know, internet service. I mean, we'll see what happens. But the interesting thing is, okay, so they want you to watch the commercials, obviously, because that's what pays for their program. So they're going to give you points for each commercial viewed. I don't know. I mean, this just seems like, okay, so we have Roku already. Sezme, which hasn't launched yet, and I can't get any word from those guys. I tried to get an interview last week with Sezme to kind of get an update on that service. That's another one of the, you know, the over-the-top plays. And I guess they've done some tests late last year. I think they're going to be launching later this year. So now we have yet another entrant. I mean, I guess the question is, Tim, I'm going to throw this to you. Do we need another one? And do you think this is the reason that that Hulu pulled itself off of Boxy? And of course, the connection with Hulu is that it's owned by NBC Universal and Fox.
I think we're going to see a lot of things going back and forth and back and forth in terms of, you know, who is in control of the content. And it's everyone's jockeying. I mean, to me, it would make more sense for somebody to buy Boxy or invest heavily in Boxy and make their content available there, because people seem to like the interface of Boxy, and it's out there. It's got a recognized name with a lot of movers and shakers in the internet world. And it just seems like it's a great way to go rather than create some new box. You know, and this is going to keep happening until TVs are totally converged, where you just turn on your TV and you can watch whatever you want to watch whenever you want to watch it.
David, you have Boxy, right?
I do.
What do you think about this? Do you use it anymore?
No, I don't. Yeah, and you know, honestly, I have my spare computer hooked up to my TV just for purposes of Hulu anyway. So
you don't have a need for it.
I don't have a need for it. But the thing I thought interesting about this was this whole concept of giving points for watching commercials.
Right, yeah. You sent me some interesting notes. So yeah. Talk about that. Does that work? Does that incentivize consumers?
It just feels sort of desperate. It's like, you know, you have 3 to 4 to 5 years of, you know, DVRs and the internet evolving to what it is today of consumers showing their behavior and making a bold statement saying, we don't want commercials, we don't want to watch commercials, and they do everything they possibly can, whether it's DVR it, download it, torrent, whatever, to not watch commercials. Why would you make a play to try and force them to do something they don't want to do? You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and you know, it actually kind of dovetails into another topic that we're going to be talking about, which is the whole idea of influencer programs. And this was something that Brian Morrissey at Adweek wrote about recently. And it's just the whole idea, it really sort of, I mean, we're seeing this more and more. I mean, it kind of blurs the line between editorial and advertising. And it's the idea that, you know, that a company or a brand would reach out to a blogger and say, hey, will you be part of this influencer program? And, I had to put the camera on Susan because I'm going to be throwing this question to her. So would you be part of an influencer program to kind of talk about, you know, to talk up our new SUV? Or I guess, you know, Panasonic flew several social media bloggers to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas to talk about Panasonic products unveiled there. Mercedes has done that for a top mommy blogger. She got to use an SUV for a week. And it was kind of funny. Ford Fiesta reached out to me a week ago, and I guess Ford Fiesta is trying to develop some kind of, you know, some kind of program to have whatever influential people test out their cars and produce online video about it. I mean, it wasn't like, do this, Daisy. It was, do you want to try out to do this? And it's like, do you love to drive? And it's funny because I'm thinking, actually, I hate to drive. Actually, I'm the worst person that you could possibly be approaching right now. Susan drives me up here. But Susan, what are the ethics? What are the concerns? Who should get involved? Or is this just kind of sort of like Walter Mossberg getting products to review? Although, I don't know, maybe he pays for them.
I think it is just like a journalist getting a product to review. It depends on how the blogger handles it, and some will go beyond the comfort of their audience, and they'll get that feedback, and they'll learn how to appropriately review a product. But there are a lot of brand advocates who are also bloggers and who love a lot of products and would be happy to try them and report on them and get new information about them. So it's a natural evolution as the press outlets become less important and bloggers become more important, that the publicists and the communication directors would want to reach to them to have them review the products. I don't see anything wrong with it at all.
Okay,
but things will go wrong.
Tim, how do you think consumers feel about it? Do you think they care at all? I mean, do readers of blogs or newspapers or whatever it is, do they care at all if somebody was, you know, paid or paid in product to review something?
I think some people do, some people don't. You know, when you look at guys like Robert Scoble or even a lot of us. I mean, there are quite a few of us that have received phones from different phone companies that allow us to shoot live video and try things out. And I know that, you know, Robert Scoble has tested out a lot of different products it's a two-edged sword. I mean, you can try out a product and not like it and be honest about it, even though you're getting paid for it. There has been some backlash, though. If you remember, Chris Brogan did something with Kmart and a Kmart gift certificate that $500 gift certificate. I forgot the actual details, but a lot of people were upset about him blogging for a gift certificate. And you know, the truth is if Chris had been paid like a fair sum for the amount of bloggers that or the amount of readers that his blog has, $500 would not be an appropriate price. He'd get much, much more.
Okay, so what happens if you don't actually like the product that the company sent you? I mean, I guess it's not that different from, you know, a publisher sending you a book to review and mm-hmm. it turns out you don't like it, or movie critics, mm-hmm. you know, going, it's just, I guess something seems, maybe it's the amount of money. I think that's what it is, you know, that it's sort of the idea of the amount of money, Susan, that, I mean, if you're, I don't know, I mean, if you're driving a Ford Fiesta,
Here's the rule.
What would you feel okay to say, wow, I really hate this car and it's a gas guzzler if it is?
Here's the rule. Be true to your audience. Be an advocate to your audience. They follow you because you're a filter that they like. And if you don't like something, say what you like, say what you don't, and always be in service to your audience, and then everyone will win.
David, you look like you have some thoughts.
No, I completely agree. It's all about being genuine, and your audience is going to know because they follow you when you're not genuine. Mm-hmm. And that's that sort of gray area that you talked about earlier is, you know, where can it go wrong? And this is where when you make the decision to positively review a product just because you're either getting paid or getting it for free, that's the line you can't cross.
And that's when people will sniff it out,
yeah.
right? I mean, they'll know that. I mean, audiences are so astute, and readers are astute, and listeners are astute, and they can tell. I mean, they'll know the difference that, okay, you don't actually use that. You don't actually practice that. It's interesting for me as a journalist. I mean, that's kind of like how I grew up in my career. And, you know, now I'm branching out and doing kind of some new ventures. So I have to think about lines, you know, and what are the lines that, I mean, this is what bloggers have to think about. I mean, this is, you know, it kind of ties loosely into the idea of influencer programs, but I think we all have to think about, you know, what are the lines in our businesses that we can and can't cross? You know, with Tim and French Made TV, I mean, obviously you think a lot about
well,
there's
a different kind of line there that I'm trying not to cross.
Well, what is it? Well, for you, but seriously, you have a line right? too. I mean, you want to make sure your content is PG-13. That's a line that you deal with every day, right?
Absolutely.
And your marketers need your content to be PG-13 to spend the money, right?
Correct. And it's you know, sometimes I have a marketer that wants me to cross the line because they think I'll get more views that way, and I probably would, but then I don't know that I'd get any more advertisers or sponsors. So yeah, we have to stay PG-13.
That's a good point. So another thing that we're going to talk a little bit about today is, you know, we've been talking about Kindle and iPhone and so on a lot recently. I've told you guys about my experience with the Kindle so far. And now the CNET reporter, Ina Fried, gosh, I'm sorry, Ina, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. She lost her Kindle last year. And which is, I've been thinking about this recently.
I hope I find it.
After I read this story, I was thinking about losing my Kindle. I'm like, oh my gosh, what if I, you know, what if I left it at gymnastics? No, I don't do gymnastics. I have a little child who does. But what if I leave it somewhere and nobody knows it's mine? And then how would I get these books? But actually, this is a really cool way that she got her books back. I don't think she has her Kindle back yet. But she downloaded the iPhone app that just came out last week that that is the official, you know, the official Kindle iPhone app. And so it's essentially synced to all of her ebooks that she'd already purchased on her Kindle. So even though she didn't have the device back, she could have them on the iPhone. So it's interesting, the whole idea of, okay, so would you want to read on your iPhone? I mean, I know we've been talking about the whole idea of having a, you know, and as Alex believes that there's going to be some kind of more Kindle-esque, but Apple-esque tablet device in a few months where you can do, you know, do your reading on it. But would you want to read books on an iPhone? I think you all have iPhones, don't you? I think everyone except me has an iPhone. Okay, so David, you're saying no. I'm going to go with you first.
Yeah, I would say I wouldn't want to read books. I'd want to read blogs, newspaper articles, things that are shorter form content. A book, maybe a chapter or two, depending on my commute, but it's not, you know, the iPhone is not ideal for reading for long periods of time. It's short burst. Otherwise, my eyes go buggy when I try and read stuff on it for long periods of time at all. So I think for short form content, it's great. I think the Kindle is ideally made for reading, you know, a whole book or sitting down for an hour or two at a time and reading. The iPhone app's pretty cool, though, when you look at it from the perspective of, you know, if you read the article about the train commute and those kinds of things, you're in a crowded area. Kindle might not be the best option for that. I think iPhone works well for catching up with certain things.
It's smaller than the Kindle?
Yeah, it's smaller.
That's funny.
It's true. I mean, you can kind of,
the Kindle is too big.
You can kind of pull it up right by your face and do a little bit more with it. You know, it's just,
we're talking like really, really crowded commutes. Susan, what do you think? Would you read on the iPhone?
I'll read anything, anywhere, anytime that I have a spare second. So to me, it's just additive.
It's smart. It's smart.
Yeah.
Who benefits the most from this? Does the iPhone benefit? Does Kindle benefit from this? I mean, from this partnership, who's the real winner? Or is this one of those win-win for everyone?
Consumer. The consumer wins.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Everybody
consumer
wins.
How about that? You know what I think is interesting about this? I think there's you know, I first heard cable operators talk about this a lot a couple of years ago, the whole idea of following the consumer. You know, and you certainly hear the wireless company CEOs talk about this as well, the idea that you could have, you know, you could use your mobile phone, for instance, to kind of program what you watch on TV, and then when you leave the house, let's say you're watching the Today Show in the morning, you're watching it on the TV, you leave the house and it automatically syncs up onto your phone, and you keep watching on your phone while you walk down to get on the bus or whatever, and then, you know, once you're at work, it syncs up to your computer. Of course, in this scenario, nobody's actually ever doing any real work. But it's the whole idea of your devices being smart enough to follow you with content. Mm. And I guess what I find fascinating about the Kindle iPhone app is that idea of that depending on where you are and what you want to use. I mean, I think about this with mm-hmm. books a lot. Well, there are certain situations where I want to read the actual book, where it's easier for me to read it on my Kindle. Or if I'm going for a walk, then that's the time when you switch over to the audiobook version of it. So I sort of like the idea mm-hmm. of what's happening here. And I guess what I would love to see, you know, when it comes to books is some way that you could buy this whole package with a book so that you could have all of those options, and you could decide, okay, it's time for my morning jog, you know, I'm gonna listen to the rest of Breaking Dawn or whatever. I don't know,
that would be, I would love that, like, you know, reading a book at home in the morning before I go to work and then throwing on my headphones, and I've tagged where I left off and it knows and it starts reading the book to me right then. That would be amazing.
Yeah. See, to get them really synced up, I think that would be pretty cool. Ebooks are you know, as you guys know, we've been talking about ebooks a lot. We've been talking about them a lot on the show, obviously, you know, with the Kindle and iPhone and whatnot, they're clearly becoming more important. I mean, publishers just seem to really be glomming onto this area right now. And just last week, Barnes & Noble announced that it's buying FictionWise. Now, FictionWise is one of the largest independent ebook retailers, and this was not really a lot of money, but Well, what do I know? It's a lot to me. We purchased it for $15.7 million plus incentives over the next 2 years. I saw this in Publishers Weekly. So this company was founded in 2000. The guys at FictionWise are going to continue to head the company. Barnes & Noble is going to operate it as a second, as kind of a separate business unit. But it's interesting to see sort of all of these different entities in the publishing business try to figure out what their ebook strategy is going to be. Who wants to take this?
I can start.
Thoughts? Okay, I want to go to David.
It's interesting because if you look at publishing, like the big booksellers, Borders, Barnes & Noble, and Books A Million, the big three in the U.S., over the last 3-4 months, they've really, in terms of physical inventory, brick and mortar stores have reduced their buys significantly because of the economy. I think this is a great move on Barnes & Noble's part to leverage, you know, an unlimited inventory with no cost to it. And knowing that this is a tremendously quickly growing category, it's a smart move on them. With Borders hurting like they are,
right,
this is a pretty good leverage move on their part. It might not pay off today or you know, right away, but over time it will.
How does this really help them? Give an example. I mean, will we just see this on the Barnes & Noble website? Will there be some way to integrate it into the store itself, the store experience?
This is going to have to be one of the key things they figure out how to do, is because their consumers are used to walking in a store, physical store, picking up books, buying them that way. The digital consumer is not necessarily walking into a Barnes & Noble store. And so they've got to take their particular audience and drive them to the ebook version that is walking in the store. So what do they do in store? What do they do with their website? What do they do with their outbound CRM campaigns? All those things are going to be interesting to watch, because if they don't get the word out there, there's not going to be a whole lot of additional revenue or conversion for them.
It's interesting. I think everybody needs an ebook play these days. What do we think is going to happen to Borders? Tim, any thoughts on that?
Well,
I didn't tell you, to prep for this question.
In Pasadena, they shut down their bathroom first. That was a key sign. There's no bathroom at Borders anymore in Old Town Pasadena. I'm serious. Yeah. So from there, it's just all downhill. They're going out of business.
That's
it. A bookstore without a bathroom, forget it. Especially when there's a Starbucks next door.
It's like that Seinfeld episode. Remember that one when George goes into the bookstore and he takes the book into the bathroom? And they're like,
Jerry doesn't want it.
Like, this has been tagged as a book that's gone into the bathroom. Yeah, but Borders, I just see, every week it seems we hear tougher and tougher news from Borders. But then again, that's no different from a lot of companies right now. Like GM, every week we hear worse and worse news from GM. What are your thoughts on Borders, Susan?
Well, my thoughts are actually on ebooks themselves. Okay. Daisy, you're writing one. I'm writing one. We know a lot of people who are writing books. Everybody has a book in them, and now it's going to be digital.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that they bought this ebook distribution business tells me that not only are they, we talked last week about the fact that there were probably a dozen Kindle competitors coming out of the chute in a short amount of time. So certainly there's going to be less of a monopoly than Amazon has today. And a whole bunch of new e-readers. But there's also just going to be a lot of content available for digital download. Mm-hmm. And right now, people are doing it themselves, and going to, what was the site, Daisy, that you said? E-Junkie?
Oh, yeah. E-Junkie. E-Junkie is just kind of something that helps you if you're getting into the e-commerce business. Right. I tried it out over the weekend. I'm going to be using it to distribute my
e-books
myself.
It's
one of those, it just helps you as an individual that's, if you're selling products on your site, that makes it easier.
So right now, you're doing it yourself. We're doing it ourselves. Everyone's putting their e-books up online with PayPal and things like that, the Facebook Marketing Bible. Everybody's got their e-book. Well, this is going to be a great platform because you're going to want to be in a directory. Somebody's going to aggregate all of this how-to and information product business into something larger and categorize it. And I think maybe it's Barnes & Noble, maybe it's not, but definitely the direction.
That's an interesting idea, that there should be a directory. And actually, that's kind of a good lead into Scribd, which is this new site. I know a PR woman over there, we were chatting last week and talking about the site. And I asked David to take a look at it, obviously, because David has an expertise from the publishing business. I'm going to spell it for you, scribd.com. So it's a really interesting site. But before I go to your review, David, I think that's such an interesting point, because we've seen happen with online video and just with the explosion of content in general, that there needs to be directories for it. There needs to be a way to navigate.
A la Yahoo.
Right, exactly. And to some degree,
sounds familiar.
One of the reasons Yoohoo.
Yoohoo. That would be the chocolate drink.
I'm mixing up Yoohoo and Hulu. Yahoo and Hulu. Sorry. One of the reasons Hulu has been successful is not just because you can get so many shows, but it's because consumers have been trained to think of it as an online directory, even though it's primarily a place to watch the shows, but it also is a place to see what is available online.
Discovery.
Exactly. It's the discovery of content. I mean, that's what people say they're getting more and more frustrated with online, is how to go through it all. So anyway, David, talk about Scribd a little bit.
Well, it's a neat site, first of all. I mean, it seemed to aggregate so many different categories of things. And one of the things that I just did a search under presentations, I put in new media as the search criteria, and it was amazing the amount of things that came up. I had all these like PowerPoint and PDF presentations, and
where were they from? Just companies,
individuals. A lot of it, I mean, there were some from like all over the world too. I pulled up one from India, and it showed different segmentation in India and how the consumers are viewing content, and it was quite interesting. And the range of quality was amazing. I saw some presentations look like they're put together by a six-year-old, and others that, you know, were super polished and super researched.
Sometimes the six-year-old presentations can be the best ones.
They can. Well, it was probably more entertaining than the other one, for sure.
Exactly.
But it's interesting, and it goes to your point, is who's going to aggregate this information in the best way? I don't think anyone's doing it great.
It needs to be curated.
Yeah.
Right? The thing that's missing. First, there'll be a directory, and then there'll be curation and a publisher and an editor and people who will help you organize it and provide a quality product, right? That's what it needs.
And it's like, you know, generally things for the average consumer have been so linear, the way they're spoken to and marketed to. You know, think of broadcast TV. You know, it's on at 8 o'clock on Channel 2, and that's when it's on. And this idea of the Wild West of on-demand content anytime, anywhere, as it moves to publishing, it's going to be confusing to the average Joe unless it is aggregated and put in a way that is easy to navigate, easy to understand, easy to find. This site does a pretty good job of it to begin with.
And I think what when I talked to the PR woman, she was saying sort of they want to be, in a way, what YouTube has become to online video. They want to be that for books and for publishing and just sort of the broader definition of books these days.
This is Scribd you're talking about?
Yeah, uh-huh. Scribd, yes.
Is it Scribd?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, oh, okay. I'm pretty sure Scribd. Although Scribd would
I would have thought
too.
Scribed because it's like a scribe. Yeah. A person who writes things is a scribe.
Yeah. You know, I think it kind of, I like
but
the
But you talked to
I,
her.
Yeah, I talked to her. It was definitely Scribd, but you know.
Okay.
I'm going to have a conversation.
They're probably just not pronouncing it.
And what I do like about it, though, what I thought was great, it just made me realize that it's in the world of publishing, like similar to video, where like now I have choices. You know, I'm not forced to digest what the networks are pushing down my throat. There's this world of video content out there, podcasting, everything else that I can thoroughly find interest for and enjoy. Now I can do that with publishing because there's so many other voices that can be heard through their writings and things that they might not be able to sell into a publisher, where here they can have a forum for it.
Now, I think places like this are very good for information, content, how to learning type of stuff, for more of the nonfiction. And I'm going to go out on a limb and be a book snob here. I cannot imagine, I cannot picture myself, unless it's something that one of my friends wrote, and you buy things your friends write because they're your friends. I cannot imagine buying fiction that was not blessed by a major publishing house. I don't know. Do you guys feel that way at all?
You always go to that. That's what you know, that is important to you. I don't think that everyone finds it that important. But the thing that I think is interesting is this notion of the celestial repository of your content accessible by any device you choose. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier, well, if I bought the book, could I also have it on my iPhone, on my Kindle, on my whatever device I want? And I think that's ultimately where it's going, is purchase once, access many.
Exactly.
Well, and I'd rather trust crowdsourcing in many cases than the publisher's opinion. If 10,000 people have read that artist's work on the site and all have given it great reviews, there's a 10,000 people I know have read it, I know have enjoyed the content. Maybe there's a community there that you know, hooks me with them so I know which users have reviewed it that have a lot in common with me. Mm-hmm. And now I've got it. I'm going to go read that because of that. I'd listen to that before I'd listen to a Penguin or a, you know, Simon Schuster telling me, hey, you should read this because, you know, we sanctioned it.
Tim, what do you think?
We all know that if Hugh Jackman's on the cover, on the key art, Daisy's going to check it out.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
I don't need words with that. Well, Tim, would you buy a novel that was sort of distributed on a Lulu or something like that? If you didn't know the author, hadn't read prior works by this author, would you just go there and kind of discover something online in a novel form? Nonfiction is a separate beast.
My guess would be that it would be a recommendation from a friend that knows my taste, mm-hmm. and that's how I would discover it. You know, the interesting thing about all these e-books and everything, it seems to be the next evolution of where we were back in 94 with CD-ROM. You know, there are a lot of the aspects of CD-ROM that were happening, and then that got derailed by the internet. And so now it's kind of rejuvenating again with ebooks, because you don't, it's not just text. You can put photos and videos and links to sites in it, and that's where it gets really exciting. And I know Alex is really excited about that. That's what he's waiting for, is when there's an ebook reader that lets you consume the video and consume the text and consume the photos and the links to other sites, and really open up the door as to what we can do with the interactivity of an ebook.
Hold on a second. So edit this out at Twim, but he's, I'm getting like,
The breath sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's too close to his mic.
Oh, Tim, you're too close to your mic. Sorry. It just happened then. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Fair. Who has seen the new look for Facebook? I don't know if anybody's seen it yet, but Mashable, there have been a lot of stories last week about Facebook having this new kind of homepage in real time. You checked it out, Susan?
Yeah. They have some samples up on the web. I looked at the Mashable one. I think it's terrific for a number of reasons. There are a couple things. One, they have something, I like to call it circles. You know, Facebook is a grand experiment in who our friends are and how we accept people into it. And for many people, they've almost accepted everyone who wanted to be a friend of theirs because they just want to see what'll happen. I mean, it's the first time we've ever had the ability to do anything like this. The downside to that is that you get a lot of information in your news stream from people who you don't know very well. So I think the biggest change for Facebook is this notion of being able to decide whose content you want to see in your news stream. So the idea that there's a circle of people who are close to you, even though you have a wider net of people who are your friends on Facebook, I think it's brilliant, and I think it's the very first step in probably a number of available delineations about what views of your content you get on Facebook. So it's kind of delineation 1.0. The second thing that I'm really glad about with Facebook is that there's a limit to how many friends you can have on Facebook, and it's 5,000. And a lot of people, including myself, are at 3,000 or 4,000 friends. And I'll tell you that I don't know them all, but because I have a show of my own, I have not only people who friend me because of that, but I have a Facebook fan club. And the problem with the fan club has always been that if you joined the fan club, it was really hard to communicate with your fans and for them to communicate with you. There wasn't really a good place to post information. They've changed that now to something they call pages. It has an unlimited number of people who can friend you. So if you are a public figure and you want to have people who want to friend you who you don't know personally, it gives you the ability to have your fan club. So I have that. I give away prizes and things all the time to my fans, and that's how I do it. I do it through a Dishy Mix fan club on Facebook. Now I can have my personal contacts, and I can have circles or views of those contacts along with something that is more my public persona, and it allows me to do that. So I think Facebook has gotten much better at understanding how we're using the platform, how various mm-hmm. people are using the platform, and what they want to do with it. And I think this new move both cleans up the UI, but it also gives you some flexibility of usage that you heretofore did not have. So I'm really happy about the upgrades and think they did a great job with it so far.
Here's what I think. And basically, essentially what Susan is saying is, I mean, Facebook is going to let you filter so that you can only see content from specific users.
Well put.
But it's kind of like TweetDeck. I mean, that's what TweetDeck does for Twitter. And I think that is great in concept, mm-hmm. and I think it probably will be cool as it plays out. But in a way, it's kind of like... I sort of see the flip side, which is like, you're only my friend as I collect friends, but you know, I don't really care what you have to say. That, I think, I still like one of the things I like about Facebook is that it's not quite as cluttered yet as Twitter is in terms of the constant updates. So I like that, you know, even if you have a certain number of friends, you know, more than 1,000, whatever it is, it still feels manageable to kind of jump in there, and I can get updates on what everyone is doing, whereas you can't do that on Twitter. It's too cumbersome. It takes up your entire day, and then you wouldn't actually do anything else. So I don't know. I don't think I would filter on Facebook. I don't think I would because I like the idea of sort of knowing what everybody is doing and having that as a spot to know.
The beauty is you can do whatever you want. Right. They have given you the control to filter or not, which is great.
I'd just be happy enough to have enough friends where I need a personal segmentation engine.
Oh, all right. Well, everybody needs to friend you then.
I'm actually like 500 or something, which isn't bad, but I do like the idea of circles.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of being able to, because I have an intimate group of close friends that, you know, I'd rather keep track of what's going on. And then there's this extended layers that circle out past that, you know, I can choose to turn on and off depending when I want that information. Yeah. This is also an interesting thing, though, when you look at it from a marketing perspective for corporations and brands.
Yeah, that's what the pages are for. Yeah. They're for brands.
And their ability to sort of have this, I call it a segmentation engine built within Facebook for them, where they can follow certain groups and watch that behavior and make decisions on their brand and their marketing because of that. So this is a pretty cool move.
I haven't found the Facebook groups to be... I haven't found anyone yet who's really, I think, using the Facebook group function in an amazing way to...
No,
I don't know. I mean, Tim, what do you think? I mean, sometimes I just feel like a little bit clunky. Like, I don't know. What do I want to get in there? What do I do? What's the purpose? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm not a big Facebook fan, just from a personal interface. I don't enjoy it as much as I do Twitter. Twitter is more immediate, and Facebook and also LinkedIn, it just seems to be a lot of work, whereas Twitter's more casual and fun, and you can check on everybody really quick. And with TweetDeck and different things like that, you know, it gives you more flexibility there as well. Although the new Facebook stuff that Susan is talking about is pretty amazing. I just haven't taken the time to jump into
it. Do you use Facebook at all, Tim? Are you on it? Or I mean, I know you're very active on Twitter. Like, do you have Twitter open all day?
I look at Twitter all the time. You know, kind of like checking your stocks or something. I look at Twitter to see what's going on.
And Twitter makes you happier these days than checking your stocks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's also, with Twitter, you can find out what's going on, especially like at a, you know, at South by Southwest. It's like, oh, Motorola party, free lobster, I'm there. You know, all your friends know immediately what party you're going to.
That's great.
So that's where the relevance comes in on Twitter. Whereas Facebook and LinkedIn, it seems to be a little more longevity and planning type stuff. I do use Facebook for events. A lot of people will send out a if there's going to be some type of conference or if there's going to be a party, they'll use Facebook as a way to get that information out. And that's what I'll use Facebook for. But I don't go through Facebook profiles and look for Facebook friends.
Have any of you tied your Twitter to your Facebook? Where when you update Twitter, it updates your Facebook status too?
I mean.
Yeah, I do that, so it syncs automatically. And, you know, it's tough because I have a lot, you know, I have personal friends and college friends and whatnot on Facebook. And I think sort of anyone probably struggles with this where you're, you know, you're connecting the two. And obviously, you know, you're trying to drive traffic to the stories I'm writing, and they may have no interest whatsoever to my college friends. But, you know, in a way, it's like I don't care that much anymore. It's not that I don't care about them, but I just mean I've had to get over the idea that they're going to pick things up in their Facebook feed. Yeah, that they're going to pick things up in their Facebook feed that they don't care about, because that's sort of the nature of the beast, is they're going to say things that aren't that interesting to me, and I'm going to pick up on the things that are interesting, and vice versa, and that's okay. So if I Twitter about cutting the cord of your cable service, and you know, 10 of my friends on Facebook are my college friends, like, why is she talking about this? But then they're talking about some, you know, concert that they went to in Providence or whatever. It's like, doesn't necessarily have any meaning to me, but it's still, you kind of know what's going on with that person. So I think the whole idea of you are mixing and matching the public and private persona to some degree, but at the same time, I feel like they're such public places regardless that you know, I mean, I try not to Twitter anything that personal.
It's called participatory media because you have a choice, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Some of the people in the chat room wonder what this show is. You might want to tell them if they're new to tuning in on the live stream.
It's this, you're listening to This Week in Media, which is a Pixel Core show, and it's all about hot topics in the media business, and we hope you'll keep tuning in, and we're going to do it pretty regularly from Leo's house. So there you go. That's your This Week in Media promo in the middle of the show. Speaking of ads, promos, Cablevision has got this big trial going on. Actually, you know, I'm sorry. It's not a trial. I think we can call it a deployment now because there's 500,000 homes. Cablevision is just a New York area cable operator. She did a really good job just kind of consolidating and saying, you know what, we're just going to have everything. We're just going to be focused in the New York area, Long Island, and whatnot. So Cablevision is using targeting technology from Visible World to basically send ads to specific households on the basis of data about income, ethnicity, gender, whatever it is. And actually, it was a couple years ago, I believe it was 2.5 years ago, it was in the summer, when Cablevision first started a trial with Visible World to about 100,000 homes in the New York area as well with this kind of targeted technology. And, you know, this is something that cable operators and anybody in the TV business has been wanting to do for a very long time, is the whole idea of delivering targeted ads. David, I know you took some good notes on this. What are your thoughts on this? How much does this help a Cablevision and the advertisers and do consumers actually want to see these ads?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's basically internet technology on cable, you know, basically segmentation.
It's about time.
Yeah, it is. Right? It really is. I mean, it's what, you know, what Amazon does every day with their algorithms. I think the problem I've always had with sort of targeted ads is I don't like, as a consumer, the idea of being pigeonholed into a set of interest or a set of demographics. I mean, while that's cool, and I think, like, you know, if I was a Spanish speaker and they're feeding me Spanish commercials, I would like that. What I would like to have is some interactivity with it, where I can go, maybe they set up a website where I can go and put additional metadata or tags that say, hey, you know, yeah, I want my commercials in Spanish, you know, and I have interest in all these other categories as well.
So you kind of like program sort of the type of ads that,
yeah,
you want to receive.
I would like some interaction with it versus just assumptions made about me based on the little bit of information they have.
But do you want to get points?
I don't want to get points.
Tie it back to Zillion TV that we talked about at the beginning. Do you want to get points for watching the ads? No.
I'd like to respectfully disagree.
Would
with you?
Okay.
David, in that, not that you have a very positive intention to customize your advertising experience in any medium, but it's more trouble than it's worth because most people won't do it.
That's true.
Many interactive companies have given their customers the option of customizing their experience, and no one does it. So it's not worth building the platform to do it. That being said, market segmented and targeted cable ads and broadcast ads are an absolute must going forward. And I'm very impressed with Visible World because a couple of years ago when I was still programming ad tech, and Daisy, you spoke there all the time with me.
And ad tech are conferences.
A conference.
Online advertising related conferences.
And that's where
world.
I met Daisy.
Yeah.
She was always one of our best moderators and speakers. And look at you now.
Thank you.
But anyway, Visible World, you know, they came and they did their pitch and they said what they were going to do. And I thought, okay, well, you know, obviously it's nirvana to be able to target broadcast and cable advertising. And it seems like they're executing, which is so great because over and over we hear, we were talking earlier about Zillion TV, yet another set-top box delivering content. You know, people have taken many, you know, the road is littered with many people who have taken runs at this, but it looks to me, I'll be looking forward to the results of the effectiveness of the targeted advertising for the advertisers, because that's what we're really talking about. Can an advertiser, is even 500,000 households enough for a brand to target a campaign and see an appreciable lift in sales based on the targeting? That's the crux of the question.
But I think what is also important, let's tie this back to, you know, consumers and listeners for a second, is, you know, will this be you know, is we need research on whether this works for them as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, it's important to know if this works for the brand, but you know, what is the Cablevision consumer feedback? Are they getting, you know, better ads? I mean, is there some way to have kind of an effective research mechanism to really understand, you know, wow, actually, I love my cable service now because I'm getting these ads that are targeted to me, or that they don't even notice. I mean, I think that's going to be
I think that's going to be key
that we want to see sort of from both sides how it plays out.
What bothers me is go ahead, Tim.
One of the cool things about a Visible World, Seth Haberman, who is the guy behind Visible World,
it's Tim's side.
They have a technology that takes you through through the whole process. So when you start with creating your spot in Avid, you can start designing the different versions of your spot. Even when you're storyboarding your spot, you can design the different versions that are going to appear. And the way that they showed it to me was that, let's say you have a car commercial for a pickup truck, and that's going to show in Detroit and Miami. In one of the areas, you might want it on the beach. In the other area, you might want it in the snow. And you might want to change that on the fly, depending on the weather or something. Mm-hmm. They're able to do that on the fly with their system. And so you can build out the different variables as you're going through the process and then deliver them and change them on the fly, which is pretty cool.
And of course, as some of our listeners are pointing out in the chat room, they go, well, I'm still going to DVR through the ad. So even if they're targeted to me, I won't notice because I'm skipping through them on my TiVo.
I'll just see them really fast.
Right, exactly. That's the key. Somebody has to develop that. I mean, I think, does TiVo do that kind of a fast forward ad? I mean, I know that was talked about before, the idea that that even while you're fast forwarding, kind of like a banner perhaps or something, like an overlay could pop up so that if it was something interesting enough, you would stop it. Have you ever stopped an ad on your TiVo or DVR go back and see what it was?
Yeah, I have.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay, can you remember what it was? Anyone?
Ooh. Movie trailer.
Movie trailer.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much like.
Speaking of movie trailers, can we talk about the new Harry Potter movie trailer? Did anybody besides me see it? It looks so awesome.
I did see it yesterday. I saw Watchmen yesterday.
Oh, you saw it? Yeah. How was it?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, the only comment I would make from a review perspective is you're much, much better off reading the graphic novel before you go.
I have heard that from other people. Yeah, definitely. So some of my friends who saw the movie wrote to me and said, yeah, it was, you know, even, I mean, it was complicated even for people who have read the novel. And and they were saying that, you know, they could imagine it would be harder. So you read it.
I had read it, yes.
Tim, did you see Watchmen?
I did. I did see Watchmen, and I'd not read the graphic novel.
And were you able to follow it?
I was able to follow it, and it very much seemed like a comic book guy's wet dream.
Well, and I think that's one of the big differences, Tim, is like if you've read the graphic novel, there's a lot more depth of character. There's a lot more background information in backstories and other different things that occur in it that didn't make it into the movie.
You know, it's funny. I had this thought yesterday. I was like, you know, I didn't see the movie this weekend. I had thought about going to see it, but I have a hard time sitting for more than like an hour and a half. When I saw the runtime was 2 hours and 40 minutes. Like, I don't know that I can do this in a theater. So then I had this moment where I thought, yeah, maybe I should read the novel first. Because I don't like to miss things. Like, when I'm at the movies, I don't like to miss things. Like, if it's complicated, I want to make sure, like, that I'm totally getting every aspect of it and understanding every aspect of it. So I was thinking, well, maybe it would be better if I read it. And then I had this thought, I'll get it on my Kindle. But, of course, that would defeat the purpose because it is a comic book and a graphic novel. So that's
I have a copy. I'll give it to you.
Oh, bring it next time. Because I have heard good things about it. So I definitely want to check it out. Yeah, I'm so excited about Harry Potter. I'm a tall Harry Potter fangirl. But I got to tell you, the trailer... It's like the fourth trailer for the Half-Blood Prince. I'm like putting in six and Half-Blood together. See, I'm like coming up with new words today. Yoo-hoo. Well, that's not a new word. Anyway, it looks amazing. I mean, the special effects look incredible.
Is it me or is like every new movie, the trailers get darker and darker?
Like, do you mean darker or do you mean in terms of like the content?
Not light and dark, I mean, but like... heavy content and like scarier.
You can see a little bit of the Inferi in this one.
Yeah.
Did you notice that? You've read the book, right?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
No.
Really?
No. Sorry.
Have you seen the movies?
I've seen all the movies. I read the first book and then I switched to movies after that.
Okay. Well, anyway, so the Inferi look really cool. For those of you who know what I'm talking about, they look amazing. My sister-in-law works at Industrial Light and Magic, which is why I have this T-shirt, because she does many of these movies, and we talked a lot about the Harry Potter movie and the special effects, and they actually, ILM won the contract. Well, I mean, they have a lot of different visual effects houses working on it, and they won the part to do the water in the cave scene, in part because of the Academy Award that they got for Pirates, because they had done such a good job with the water scene, especially in the, which was the Pirates movie that had the big, huge, like, torrent of water that, you know, Colleen, was it two or three?
The Vortex.
It was three, yeah. Three, yeah. So anyway. So there you go. That's the Harry Potter thing. Just, interesting eMarketer report. This should make all of us happy. eMarketer put out a report last week saying, podcasting is on a growth track. Thanks to symbiotic consumer behavior, technology, and content trends, the popularity of the medium has created an environment in which increasing numbers of media companies have repurposed content from their radio or TV broadcasts as podcasts. Like, okay, I don't know how much we really want to talk about this, because we're all sort of drinking the Kool-Aid here with podcasts already. Yeah. But at the same time, I think it's still, it's good to see, you know, continued endorsements from a company like eMarketer, which I think is very well respected as a research source. So it's just nice to kind of see those endorsements of podcasts. Anything, Susan?
Yeah, Paul Verner wrote that report, and I haven't read the whole thing yet. It's just out, so I'm working on acquiring a copy. But one of the things that I think is interesting is that, of course, the big brands are coming to podcasting as another distribution channel for existing content, but there are also so many companies like Next New Networks. I know we're going to talk about them a little later. On Networks, Personal Life Media, blah, blah, blah. There's a ton of companies that are brand new organizations that have been built around the possibility of portable content distribution. And so I think that's important to note as well. Yeah.
Do we think there's really an opportunity? I mean, are there new brands or advertisers that are coming in to support this media? I mean, is this, are we sort of at the point with podcasting that, I don't know, is it crossing some kind of threshold where we'll see, you know, bigger and bigger names come into the medium? And I bring this up, obviously, because clearly we'd like to see it. I mean, we love our listeners. We're glad that you listen to the show. We like what we do. We want to be able to continue doing what we do. And, you know, we all need someone to pay the bills.
Yeah.
I mean, are there newer names coming into the space, Susan?
Yeah, there are. There are new names, new sponsors coming in all the time. I think it's set us back a little bit. We expected a really good year for advertising in the podcast and vidcast world that will probably not be as good as we'd hope because of the market decline and advertisers cutting their budgets. Nonetheless, new brands keep coming in to sponsor this content for two reasons. One, there's enough scale now. And also, you know, I work with the Association for Downloadable Media, and our job is to build the standards around both audience metrics, download numbers, as well as ad formats. And so now there are over 30 companies that have adopted a standard for advertising models and units so that an advertiser can buy across networks and even in individual content owners who have maybe a single show. There's some scalability that has heretofore not been available to bring that money into the market. So a couple things are happening that make that good.
Tim, you look like you want to say something.
Adam Carolla just jumped into podcasting.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And, talk about that.
You know, I mean, that's huge.
Is he bringing advertisers along with him?
I haven't tuned in to his show yet, but when CBS dumped their talk radio format, he went to podcasting. So that speaks volumes.
I guess here's what I wonder, though. I mean, can the internet really support everybody that gets canned? I mean, to be quite frank, because, I mean, we're certainly seeing, obviously, a lot of journalists are losing their jobs. I mean, a lot of people in general clearly are losing their jobs, and, you know, and they're turning to the internet, whether it's to launch their own web show. I mean, there was a Bay Area television reporter, and he lost his job, and then he started up kind of a tech-centric web show. Obviously, we're seeing Adam do that. Clearly, he comes with a fan base, but I have to wonder, you know, it's not just can the internet, I mean the infrastructure, but are there enough audiences to support everybody? I mean, I wonder if, you know, I mean, think about all the papers that are shutting down and the businesses, the publications that are challenged right now. To some degree, isn't that simply because there's just too much content and maybe we don't really want to read or, you know?
I'd say,
see it all?
Daisy, typically what happens is that someone like Adam Carolla goes off on their own and they'll launch into the podosphere, or this reporter will start their own, you know, weekly video show. But then they'll get consumed by a larger publisher. Mm-hmm. Publishers are always looking to, I'm always looking to acquire the right properties that fit my network, my profile, my demographic. I can cross promote them. I can expand my audience for my advertisers. So yes, absolutely. Not only can the internet absorb it, if they're good and they bring an audience from the, you know, the meat space into the internet world, they will get snapped up if they have a quality product. Absolutely.
David,
I just wanted to jump on Susan's earlier point about advertising budgets. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting also from a trend is, even though the budgets are lower with the economy and everything like that, the share of those budgets is being shifted away from, you know, spray and pray to very targeted. And the great thing about podcasting is you have the ability to show a potential advertiser that you're reaching their audience very specifically. And that's very appealing to marketers, because they'd rather have 10,000 quality people they're marketing to than 100,000 guessing as to whether those people are interested in their brand or products. So the share is shifting.
So, Tim, what do you think about Zadie and Steve going doing a show again for Next New Networks?
I think that's fantastic that they didn't burn that bridge, and that they, you know, were smart enough to keep a relationship going on with Fred and Next
New Networks. Now, set that up for listeners who might not be familiar with them, just kind of the backstory with Epic Foo and Next New.
Steve Wolf and Zadie Diaz had a show called Jet Set, and they went to Next New Networks with that show. They changed their name from Jet Set to Epic Foo. They left Next New Networks and went to Revision 3, and then Revision 3 left them. And instead of taking Epic Foo back to Next New Networks, they created a new show that Next New Networks has picked up.
Now, are they still doing Epic Foo, Tim? Is that still on? Because I haven't seen a fresh episode since, I think, late January. I know I should ask Zadie directly.
Yeah, you know what? There are things that I know that I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about, so I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, don't say anything that would compromise your integrity.
There you go.
But no, I agree with you. It's really, I mean, I just think it's encouraging sort of from a human interest standpoint, if you will, because the fact is it's really good not to burn bridges. And I think there was a lot of speculation. I don't know if... I don't know the details of when they left originally, but there was certainly a lot of speculation amongst the, you know, new media, Cognoscenti and whatnot, about, you know, about why they left. But it's really nice to see that it's like, okay, whatever the reasons were, they weren't significant enough that you can't do business with them together again. And I think so often that, you know, we find once you've been doing business for more than a couple of years, you come back to the same people. You might lose a client 1 year, and then you pick up new business from them the next year. You know, they might need to scale back for whatever reason. So you have this parting of ways, and they had a better opportunity at the time to go with Revision 3, and then that didn't work out, and they do the show on their own, and now they have another show, and they're back with Next New Networks. And I just kind of, it's sort of a happy moment in some ways to see that everybody can work together again. One more story that I wanted to get to, that it came out in the Wall Street Journal on Friday. I thought this was pretty interesting. I didn't send this out to my guests in advance, because I just found it over the weekend. But it's kind of cool. It's about these new sort of renegade iPhone app stores, the Cydia store, Rock Your Phone. I don't know if any of you, did you see this journal article?
I haven't seen it.
It's a pretty cool article. Susan and I were talking about it on the way up here, but it's a whole idea of there are kind of these new stores that are cropping up for iPhone users that have applications that you can't get in the regular iPhone app store. And of course, in first blush, you might be just thinking it's adult content. And yes, some of it will be adult games, but there's other things. In this one store, in the Cydia store, there's an application called Cycorder. It turns the iPhone into a camcorder. And that's something that, you know, Apple doesn't allow that in its app store. There's another program which costs $29, dubbed PDAnet, that lets people use their iPhones as laptop modems to connect to the internet. You can probably figure out why Apple wouldn't allow that.
Are these only for jailbroken iPhones,
yes,
then?
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's the thing. I mean, the big challenge with this is, yes, you have to hack into your iPhone. I wonder how many people do that. I know that Susan and I were discussing whether, she's like, no, I haven't hacked into my iPhone. David, Tim, have you hacked into your iPhones?
Have not.
Tim?
No, have not.
Do you know how?
Yeah, you Google it. Yeah,
I can find out in about 4 seconds.
Right, exactly. I know. It's kind of amazing. So I mean, it's just kind of an interesting development. It reminds me again, sort of in the underground way of what we were talking about at the beginning. Everyone is getting in business with each other and getting in bed together, and you can read your books here and there, and it follows you around. And it's like, okay, there's this huge market with iPhones, of course, and people are realizing it with the App Store in general. And if you want to hack around a little bit, you can do more with it. It's just going to be interesting to kind of see how that takes off. So if anyone wants to look that up, that was in the Friday, March 6th Wall Street Journal. Cover of the marketplace. Yes, I'm sure. Go to your recycling bins. You have the actual newspaper copy like I do. Anyway, a couple other little things that I wanted to discuss, and then we're going to wrap it up. I wanted to let you know I've been talking about what I had previously called a white paper. I talked about how I'm doing white papers, and I actually decided I'm going to call them ebooks now, because I decided that white paper kind of sounds like a position statement from a company, and I was calling it a white paper, and the first one I'm doing is on fair use, kind of fair use of content, and really looking into the fair use doctrine, try to help both new media producers, but journalists, documentarians, whatnot, really understand that, and that's going to be coming out, I hope, my goal is for it to come out in about 2 weeks, and actually I have a sponsor, an underwriter for it, so I'm really excited about that. HitViews, which is an online, you probably know them, Tim, an online entertainment studio. They're going to be my underwriter for that. So I'm happy about that. And I decided to call them ebooks because I think that's a better term, again, than white paper. So, and I'm going to offer a special promo rate for TWIM listeners, and I'll get you that in a week or two once it's all ready. Okay, the other thing we need to talk about is last year, I did a contest in the New Media Minute and with TV Week for the web's sexiest male host. And, Leo Laporte did very well in it.
I remember this.
he was one of the original nominees. He did very well. And I think he wound up coming in second or third. I'm not sure. Actually, the winner was David Price of The Middle Show. So we had David Price was one of the original contestants. Martin Sargent. I mean, obviously, Kevin Rose, Alex Albright. So I'm going to do this again, of course. And so I need people's suggestions on who should be nominated and included in that first round. So you don't have to have them this moment. If you do, feel free to, ping me on chat or email me, daisywhitney@gmail.com with your suggestions about who should be included in my contest for the web's sexiest male host. I'm all about, equal opportunity objectification. Tim, I just look at you laughing. Come on, who should I have in there?
Well, I'm thinking that Hugh Jackman should start a podcast.
stop it. Enough of the Hugh Jackman humor. I think that's all for today. So I will let you know about show notes. And if they're up this week, I'll Twitter those. If they are up this week, if not next week.
Thanks to Joy.
Yes, thanks to Joy. Thank you, Joy, for doing our show notes. Let's go around the horn. Susan, where can people find you?
Well, my show is Dishy Mix, and it's an audio podcast, a weekly show. As a matter of fact, tomorrow I have Nolan Bushnell, the inventor of Atari and Chuck E. Cheese,
very cool.
Coming out.
Oh,
he's
cool.
Doing two new companies that he's going to tell you all about. So that's Dishy Mix, but that's on my network of podcasts called Personal Life Media. You can find me on Twitter at Susan Brown. And also, of course, on Facebook, DishyMixFan.com.
You're all over the place. You're going to have to decide how you want to find Susan.
It's
people.
Easy. Find me everywhere.
Exactly. That's the key.
Like friends.
So find me everywhere. David, where do you want people to find you?
Oh, a couple of places. First of all, working on a new martial arts podcast that we're going to be, we're in planning stages right now. It's going to be very cool. Motion capture, all this really neat stuff focused around the science of martial arts.
I like
which
that.
Will be pretty neat, yeah. But you can find me at battletraining.com. That's my martial arts site. You can find me on Twitter, David Rewalt, and you can find me on Facebook at David Rewalt.
Tim, where can we find you?
You can find me at my website, apedigital.com, apedigital.com, and at my blog, onetimstreet.com.
Can we change your name officially to One Tim Street? That would
there
just
go.
Make
Absolutely.
It easier.
Here,
I'm going to introduce you now from here to four as One Tim Street. You can find me on my website at daisywhitney.com and follow me on Twitter, please, at the same. My Twitter handle is Daisy Whitney. We are over and out. Thank you very much.